from March 12, 2000, A Tale of Two Kingdoms, Part 17. Okay, let's see, I'll start with an announcement. Next week I'll be gone. You can go to Dr. Noel's class on the Chronicles. I'll be in Scotland, though, so I'm planning on worshiping at the Airdrie Reformed Presbyterian Church. The pastor's name is Andrew Quigley. Yeah, well, he's one of the churches that the RP Summer Missions have worked with, so. Or that's one of the churches there, so should be interesting. Okay. Okay, so we left off last time with the church was protesting the imposition of these Tilchin bishops. And they were sort of sparring, or, you know, they were arguing back and forth with Morton over the relationship between the church and the civil magistrate, the two kingdoms. And he had tried various things to, I guess you could say, annoy the church or harass the church. He was appointing these bishops, and he commanded one of them basically not to be subject himself to examination. He had, though, told the church that they should, if they didn't like the Leith Concordat, that they should draw up their own document, which they finally did. Okay, but Morton, just to keep you up to date with the events in the civil magistrate, he soon had trouble enough of his own. James was 11, nearly 12, in the spring of 1578. Mary was still in, quote, captivity, although there were still forces at work that might conspire to try to put her back on the throne. Or I'd say there certainly were forces at work conspiring to put her back on the throne, it's just they were never successful. Let's see, a distant cousin, Captain James Stewart. This is Knox's brother-in-law. Okay. He's a bit of a troublemaker. But he appeared, he entertained the king with stories of bravery and rumors about the regent. I think he obtained a reputation as sort of one of the corruptors of the king. The earls of Argyll and Athol, who were once enemies, were now united against Morton. They rebelled and were outlawed. And instead of fleeing, they went to visit the king with armed retainers. And we don't know exactly what happened, but think that he, you know, they basically came in and, you know, sort of bowed down before the king and gave their side of the story. And Morton had instructed the king not to see them. They should be sent away without an audience if they came. But he gave them an audience, and Morton informed the king that if he undermined the administration of justice by doing this sort of thing, that he would have to find himself another regent. So the king accepted Morton's resignation on the 6th of March, 1578. Argyll and Athol were nominally in charge, but within 2 months, there was another coup. There was a scuffle at the castle that the king was at. The scuffle involved a couple of the king's men being, or guards being run through with swords. And Morton was effectively back in charge again, although he didn't bother to claim the title of regent again. Okay, at about the same time, in April 1578, the second book of discipline was approved by the General Assembly. Been written by a committee of, I think, about 40 ministers, of whom Andrew Melville was one of the members. And it was officially, let's see, included in the minutes of assembly in 1581. So there's, I read somewhere where it appeared in 1581, but it actually appeared earlier. But I think they added some, they ordered presbyteries to obtain a copy in 1581 and so on. kind of an interesting book. I read one of the authors that I've been reading, James Hewison King, said the second book of discipline differs so little from the first book that it may be considered its complement. Now, I don't know if that's a typo of some sort, because it is a complement, a complementary volume, but it does differ somewhat from the first book, and that things are more refined, especially the proper relationship between the two kingdoms. So the book itself consists of 209 paragraphs under 13 headings. And just to give you an idea, what I'd like to do is bring up the sort of things that tend to be different in the second book of discipline. 13 paragraphs. The first one is called "Of the Kirk and Policy Thereof in General, Wherein It Is Different from the Civil Policy. So there's, first of all, this one and one or two other chapters primarily refine this relationship between the two kingdoms. And I'm going to skip over part of it. I guess I won't say everything I'm skipping over is definitely in the first book of discipline, but the things that I noticed or jumped out at me were that the this relationship between the civil magistrate and the church is laid out in, let's see, the first section, about the last half. So, "It is proper to kings, princes, and magistrates to be called lords and dominators over their subjects, whom they govern civilly. It is proper to Christ only to be called Lord and Master of the spiritual government of the Kirk. And all others that bear office therein ought not to usurp dominion therein, nor be called lords, but only ministers, disciples, and servants. For it is Christ's proper office to command and rule in his Kirk universal, and every particular Kirk, through his Spirit and Word, by the ministry of men. Notwithstanding, as the ministers and others of the ecclesiastical estate are subject to civil magistrate, so ought the persons of the magistrate be subject to the Kirk spiritually and in ecclesiastical government. And the exercise of both these jurisdictions cannot stand on one person ordinarily. The civil power is called the power of the sword, and the other the power of the keys. The civil power should command the spiritual to exercise and do their office according to the word of God. The spiritual ruler should require the Christian magistrate to minister justice and punish vice, and to maintain the liberty and quietness of the Kirk within their bounds. The magistrate commands external things for external peace and quietness among the subjects. The minister handles external things only for conscience' cause. The magistrate handles external things only in actions done before men, but the spiritual ruler judges both inward affections and external actions in respect of conscience by the word of God." "The civil magistrate craves and gets obedience by the sword and other external means, but the ministry by the spiritual sword and spiritual means. The magistrate neither ought to preach, minister the sacraments, nor execute the censures of the church, nor yet prescribe any rule how it should be done, but command the ministers to observe the rule commanded in the word and punish the transgressors by civil means. The ministers exercise not the civil jurisdiction, but teach the magistrate how it should be exercised according to the word. The magistrate ought to assist, maintain, and fortify the jurisdiction of the Kirk. The ministers should assist their princes in all things agreeable to the word, provided they neglect not their own charge by involving themselves in civil affairs. Finally, as ministers are subject to the judgment and punishment of the magistrate in external things that they offend, so ought the magistrates to submit themselves to the discipline of the Kirk if they transgress in matters of conscience and religion." Okay, so this represents, this is a, a cannon shot across the bow, or more than that, probably more a cannon shot aimed at the right broadside at the ship of the divine right of kings. So before, what the kings, of course, were claiming was that they had the right to, among other things, appoint bishops and really have control of the church. And so, in a sense, rule both kingdoms. And they claimed they were divinely anointed by God. You remember our little quote from last week where the Countess of Mar said, "Well, how dare you lay your hands on the Lord's anointed?" Since they were anointed by God, they felt they had this divine right to rule, and to rule not only the civil magistrate, but the church. And this is really, says quite the opposite. It lays out this view of what I've been calling the two kingdoms. This is the one day so far that I wished I had a whiteboard to use. I have a little chart here that I drew. It basically shows Christ ruling over the Kirk, the church, and the state. And under the church, we have the elders, minister, well, various classes of elders, the ministers and doctors and so on, ruling over the masses, if you will. And that those masses, though, include the king. They include his lower officials, his magistrates. And then on the other side, we have Christ ruling over the state. And then we have the king at the top and his magistrates. And then the masses, which would in this case include the ministers and elders. So it's really a picture of two kingdoms in parallel, both ruled by Christ, but ruled separately, with separate hierarchies. And this, of course, was quite offensive to the king, because it makes him no more than, you know, one ruler of two kingdoms, and instead of being a little god when it comes to religious matters, he's actually subject to the ministers and elders. This is at the heart the cause of the controversies in Scotland before this and for yet another century to come. So, you know, we're going to see this theme is going to keep recurring, but I think it's, you know, it's the I believe it is the correct view of how the two kingdoms should be related. And this, even if you read many historians, basically claim that the church's prerogative here is too high. I mean, among other things, ministers can pass judgments on internal, inward affections, and the ministers could preach to the king and, you know, sort of tell him what to do. But of course, the king, in a sense, couldn't tell the ministers what to do. They see it as sort of a lopsided policy. But on the other hand, the ministers, right, they can preach to the king, and they could discipline the king, but I think primarily it would be a matter of preaching that they would find offensive. And their discipline, of course, the ultimate discipline they have is excommunication. Dr. Rees, a question.
Doesn't it have any way to stand any chance of working?
This is a model for a Christian state. It probably is. I mean, whether or not the king would be internally regenerated or not, it could probably still work, but the king certainly would have to make an outward profession of faith in order for it to work. So, well, I don't know. I mean, it works in some degree. I mean, in a sense, it's the system that we have is sort of a derivative of that. And I say we, I mean America. Not we as England and America. Right? But we have this separation of church and state. This isn't the same kind of separation, obviously, as people, you know, the ACLU refers to today, but it is a separation of powers, and that is what we have constitutionally. Mr. Edmondson.
Well, I was answering the question I still have. My idea is that Jesus got along with it. You know, he's still in, if we wanted to have a Christian nation, he still has to be put under some sort of moral restraint to preach to you. You know, it will have a good effect on him.
Yeah, no, I think that's the case. Even if he's an unbeliever, if he sort of nominally submits, it can still work. It's just.
You know, I like to have it. Once it's done, but if I was a father of this church, sir, I had been skeptical. But maybe some benefit.
I'd like to think I was going to win the Nobel Prize next week, too, but. I. Sir, your wishes have no bearing on the truth of the matter. Okay, the second chapter, then, is on the parts of the policy of the Kirk and persons or office bearers to whom administration is committed. Right, if we go back to the first book of discipline, you can sort of see some Presbyterian ideas, but it's not, certainly not fully thought out, and there's all these intermediate measures like readers and superintendents particularly. And by now, this is what, some 18 years later that we're talking about, by now a lot of these issues have been more sort of fully crystallized. And so in a number of policies, they lay out what the actual officers are, and also pointedly point out that there isn't, there's no such hierarchical thing as a bishop that's appointed by the king and rules over part of the church. So they definitely deny episcopacy. Let's see. This is starting with the fourth paragraph. And to take away all occasion of tyranny, he will that they should rule with mutual consent of brethren in equality of power, every one according to their functions. So speaking of the minister, so there's no no inequality of power. Let's see. In the New Testament time of the evangel, he has used the ministry of the apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, and doctors in the administration of the word, the eldership for good order and administration of discipline, the deaconship to have the care of ecclesiastical goods. Some of these ecclesiastical functions are ordinary, and some extraordinary or temporary. There are three extraordinary functions: the office of the apostle, of the evangelist, and of the prophet, which are not perpetual, and now have ceased the Kirk of God, except when he pleased extraordinarily for a time to stir some of them up again. There are four ordinary functions or offices in the Kirk of God: the office of the pastor, minister, or bishop, in other words, those are all the same thing, the doctor, the presbyter or elder, and the deacon. Now, of course, we talked a little bit about doctors last week and how it's a form of it, the doctor is an elder, they're calling it a separate office. But just as a completely side tangent from everything else we're talking about, I found this interesting. They say that the offices of apostle, evangelist, and prophet have ceased in the Kirk of God, except when he pleased extraordinarily for a time to stir some of them up again. So that is kind of an interesting statement.
That seems to be more a statement of how things are rather than a doctrinal statement. In other words, we don't see them.
Yeah. But I guess there, if you recall, do you remember this thing, I think I mentioned this about Knox supposedly having foretold that this Kirkcaldy of Grange, he would be hung facing the sun, and then supposedly when they hung him, his body sort of rotated around into the sun. Well, a lot of people that time called that a prophetic statement. And I mean, it's all lost, sort of shrouded in the mists of time as to whether or not Knox actually said that, or if he said it, he just meant in the natural, I would think he just meant in the natural course of events, if you don't cease from what you're doing, or it's holding this castle for the Queen's party, it's eventually going to end in you being hung. I don't know about this in the face of the sun, but one of the reasons I found that interesting is I get these emails from Stillwater Revivals. I don't know if any of you, anybody else get those? We're extending the super sale for this. Well, they don't say how many, so the 17th time, but on and on and on. Well, in the last one, I just happened to look at it, and there was actually somebody in their church had asked this question about this sort of thing, in other words, prophetic voices and so on. And they had a statement about it, which was, fairly moderate, but left open the possibility that someone might, with the direction of the Holy Spirit, someone might say something that would be, in a sense, prophetic. It partly comes up because when you read, not so much now, but when we read more of the covenanter histories, and they were under this incredible persecution. There were a number of instances of ministers basically making these sort of prophetic statements. And it's kind of interesting. Anyways, it's really a tangent for what I want to get at, which is the two kingdoms, but it's kind of interesting side note. Dr. Reese.
Yeah. At a day when their skull declares they could see the sun, that would be Scotland.
Oh. Okay. Oh, I didn't think about that. He was also forecasting that the sun would be out. That's a. Okay, let's see. These are the next paragraph. These offices are ordinary and ought to continue perpetually in the Kirk as necessary for the government and policy of the same, and no more offices ought to be received or suffered in the true Kirk of God established according to his words. Therefore, all the ambitious titles invented in the kingdom of Antichrist and in his usurped hierarchy, which are not of one of these four sorts, together with the offices depending thereupon, in one word, ought to be rejected. I don't know, I think that's four words, ought to be rejected. So in other words, specifically bishops, but I mean certainly, you know, cardinals and other sorts of appointments are just pointedly rejected here. Okay, chapter 3, how the persons that bear ecclesiastical functions are to be admitted to their office. I would say in general this is similar to the first book. It's not quite so detailed if you recall that there were certain, in terms of calling like superintendents and so on, there were supposed to be notices posted around the kingdom and all this kind of detail. It's not so detailed here, but there's certainly the same idea of examination and so on. One thing that does come up, let's see, this is the fifth paragraph. In the order of election, it is to be eschewed that any person be intruded in any office of the offices of the Kirk, contrary to the will of the congregation to whom they are appointed, or without the voice of the eldership. None ought to be intruded or entered in the places already planted, or in any room that is not that vakes not is not vacant for any worldly respect, and that which is called the benefice ought to be nothing else than the stipend of the ministers that are lawfully called and elected. Okay, so again, this idea of the Tolchin bishops, and also in various, there were churches that had benefices, so the Morton and his other nobles were trying to appoint both bishops and collect their, most of the benefice, and also ministers, and pay the minister a stipend and collect the rest of the benefice themselves. So this idea is, this is called intrusion when they force a pastor on a church, and this remains an issue not only for the next century but as late as 1843. Right, the Free Church of Scotland split off from the Church of Scotland over this issue. So they refused to have intruded pastors. Okay. Also, in this, let's see. At the same assembly, paragraph 8, there was a separate motion that passed on this, and it said all these office bearers should have their own particular flocks amongst whom they exercise their charge. All should make residence with them and take the inspection and oversight of them, every one in his vocation. And generally, these two things ought they all to respect: the glorifying of God and edifying of his Kirk and discharging their duties in their calling. So any of the bishops who were existing, they were told that they had to take a pastorate. So I think there was one bishop there, the Bishop of Galloway, I forget. Anyways, at this meeting, he went and took a pastorate then. Okay. Let's see, in the next chapter of the office bearers in particular, and first of the pastors or ministers, again, some of the same things that we saw before, some about when they may, what the pastor's responsibilities, but particularly pastors, bishops, or ministers, are they who are appointed to particular congregations. In other words, again, denying this idea that a bishop might be appointed to rule over a number of congregations. Let's see, the chapter 5 of doctors in their office and of the schools. Again, there's nothing near the sort of comprehensive plan that was in the first book of discipline. It's just kept to six paragraphs. let's see, I talked some last week about doctors being elders of a type, but let's see, I think they lay this out specifically. His office is to open up the mind of the Spirit of God and the Scriptures simply, without such applications as the minister uses, to the end that the faithful may be instructed and sound doctrine taught, and that the purity of gospel be not corrupted through ignorance or evil opinions. He is different from the pastor not only in name but in diversity of gifts. For the doctor is given the word of knowledge to open up by simple teaching the mysteries of faith. To the pastor the gift of wisdom to apply the same by exhortation to the manners of the flock as occasion craves. Under the name and office of doctor we comprehend also the order in schools, colleges, and universities which has been from time to time carefully maintained as well among the Jews and Christians as among the profane nations. The doctor being an elder, as is said, he should assist the pastor in the government of the Kirk and concur with the elders, his brethren, in all assemblies. By reason, the interpretation of the word, which is the only judge in ecclesiastical matters, is committed to his charge. Okay. And, but to preach to the people, to minister the sacraments, and to celebrate marriages pertains not to the doctor unless he is otherwise orderly called. Howbeit the pastor may teach in the schools, as he who also has the gift of knowledge oftentimes meet before, as the examples of Polycarp and others testify. So this doctor, I mean, again, is an elder, is a teacher of the word, is not the same thing as a pastor. And it's, I mean, to me, to my way of thinking, I mean, the most obvious application is someone who teaches at a school, college, or university. So, still not clear exactly how else it would have been used, but there you have it. So, okay, the next, we go on to chapters on the elders and assemblies of elders and then deacons. So in chapter 6 of elders in their office, let's see, the word elder in the scripture sometimes is the name of age, sometimes of office. When it is the name of an office, sometimes it is taken largely, comprehending as well the pastors and doctors as them who are called seniors or elders. In this our division, we call those elders whom the apostles call presidents or governors. I note the language there. You know, we've talked occasionally about how the Presbyterian form of church government has a parallel in the Republican form of civil government with the hierarchy, the division of, or not division of power, but this, you know, not, there's not a concentration of power in the Republican form of government. I have language here, even, you know, if you look, presidents and governors, there's our two, in this country, our two high offices. Okay. One thing that's changed a little bit from the first book of discipline, I think, is that the elders once lawfully called to the office and having gifts of God meet to exercise the same may not leave it again. In the first book of discipline, the idea wasn't, I think, was that the elders would probably retain their eldership for a long period of time, but they were elected annually with this was sort of safeguard against anyone perpetuating themselves in office when they didn't deserve to be there. And this idea seems to have shifted some to this perpetual eldership, right, which is a... Well, I guess I don't know if it's universal in Presbyterian circles today. I mean, certainly the practice of our denominations and others, but I don't know. Rob, do you know, does the PCA, are they elders in perpetuity, or are they elected on a...
I believe...
perpetuity?
Well, the congregation in Virginia didn't
apply. So I thought I'd heard of them being somewhere on a term basis. I don't remember if it was the PCA or a particular congregation, or...
Well, they might be sort of both. They won't serve in that office or they have to be reestablished there, but they might still be considered an elder. I don't remember.
Okay. Okay. I don't really know the situation, but it seemed like I vaguely recall reading about some other Presbyterian denomination. Maybe not that it was their policy, but just something about, you know, term eldership. And I was a little surprised. But Okay, it is not necessary that all elders be also teachers of the word, albeit chiefly they ought to be such, and so are worthy of double honor. What manner of persons they ought to be refer to the express word of God, and namely the canons written by the Apostle Paul. Their office is, as well severally as conjunctly, to watch diligently upon the flock committed to their charge, both publicly and privately, that no corruption of religion or manners enter therein. As the pastors and doctors should be diligent in teaching and sowing the seed of the word, so the elders should be careful in seeking the fruit of the same in the people. Okay, so they had more or less the same concept of elders that, you know, that we have, not surprisingly. Mr. Bucato.
You should ask Mrs. Bucato. She remembers better than me. They're forced to take sabbatical so that they aren't in their perpetual. They have to take a break for a few years, I don't know how long, and then they come back.
Okay.
They're elected and not very good.
Okay. Do they actually have to take sabbaticals? And
yeah, so that they're not serving constantly.
Okay.
What would be the argument for having a lifetime appointment of elders?
I think the basic argument is that the eldership is, it's an office ordained by God, and it's not, once a man's appointed to be an elder, it's a very serious sort of position. Someone with those gifts is called to be an elder. That's what they're called to be. It's not something you just do for a couple of years to do your turn. So, I don't know. I wouldn't say that's the complete biblical argument for it, but that's the basic idea.
I can't remember anything in the New Testament talking about an elder where they imply that type of longevity.
I certainly can't think of anything that would apply that it's a 2-year office or a 4-year office. So, okay. Okay, there is, of course, let's see. There is also in here things for discharging elders, you know, if it becomes necessary. And later on, there's sort of a list of things that an elder could be discharged for. But it is mentioned in this chapter that their principal office is to hold assemblies with the pastors and doctors, who are also of their number, for establishing of good order and execution of discipline, unto the which assemblies all persons are subject that remain within their bounds. Then the next chapter is called Of the Elderships and Assemblies and Disciplines and Discipline. And here's where we see really, I think, primarily the establishment of a Presbyterian form of church government that's hierarchical in the sense that there's that the church sessions are subject to, in this case, provincial sessions, which are in turn subject to national assemblies. And then they also bring in this idea of international assemblies, which, there were some in those days. So, okay, let's see. Assemblies are of 4 sorts. For either they are particular kirks and congregations, one or more of a province, or of a whole nation, or of all and diverse nations professing one Jesus Christ. This in Scotland, the presbyteries would actually have been somewhere between the provincial, when smaller than a provincial assembly. So it's not yet the final form of Scottish church government, but it's. But I think you see all the ideas are present at this stage. So in the assemblies, a moderator should be chosen by the common consent of the whole brethren convened, who should propose matters, gather the votes, and cause good order to be kept in the assemblies. Diligence should be taken, chiefly by the moderator, that only ecclesiastical things be handled in the assemblies, and that there be no meddling with anything pertaining to the civil jurisdiction. So it's kind of interesting. They do try to maintain the separation between the kingdoms explicitly here. Also, the moderator, of course, is chosen by the representatives to the assembly, not by the king. Let's see here. Okay, every assembly has power to send forth from them of their own number one or more visitors to see how all things are ruled in the bounds of their jurisdiction. Visitation of more kirks is no ordinary ecclesial office in the persons of one man, read a bishop. Neither may the name of a bishop be attributed to the visitor only. Neither is it necessary to abide always in one man's person. But it is part of the eldership to send out qualified persons to visit Perenata. Okay, the final end of all assemblies is first to keep the religion and doctrine purity without error and corruption, next to keep comeliness and order in the kirk. They have the power to execute ecclesiastical discipline and punishment upon all transgressors and proud contemners of the good order and policy of the kirk. And so the whole discipline is in their hands. So again, this idea, I mean, it's not completely spelled out here, but this idea of having a hierarchical church court system, I mean, it's basically here, is that you... someone could be, say, disciplined by their kirk session, and they could appeal to the provincial session, and so on. And it maybe doesn't come out quite as clearly here, but I think it's in here implicitly. Yes, Rob.
Does that apply to pastors as well? I mean, are the pastors actually part of their local congregations at this point?
The pastors are part of the local kirk session. I think, though, I can't remember here. It may come out. Pastors may be... It may be that they would be disciplined by the sort of next assembly up rather than their kirk session. I don't remember. So it's a key point. But if I sort of scan through here, I may come across it again. But okay. So anyways, it's then after it sort of covers the outline. It then goes through what the responsibilities of each kind of assembly are. So there's five? Yeah, eight paragraphs on the kirk session. So let's see. Let me read the first paragraph here. The first kind and sort of assemblies, although they are within particular congregations, yet they exercise the power, authority, and jurisdiction of the kirk with mutual consent, and therefore bear sometimes the name of the kirk. When we speak of the elders of particular congregations, we mean not that every particular parish can or may have their own particular elderships, especially to landward. I guess landward in Scotland meant more and more rural congregations. But we think three or four, more or fewer particular kirks may have one eldership common to them all to judge their ecclesiastical causes. So, I mean, if churches were small enough that they couldn't have their own board of elders, then they could, you know, several of them together could have a board of, or a session of elders. And this could also be the forerunner of the presbytery level assembly. Okay. The power of these particular elderships is to give diligent labors in the bounds committed to their charge, that the kirks be kept in good order, to inquire diligently of naughty and unruly persons, and to travail to bring them in the way again, either by admonition or threatening of God's judgments, or by correction. This, of course, by some historians, this is the nadir of Presbyterian tyranny, the fact that they would inquire diligently of naughty and unruly persons. It's their responsibility to take heed that the word of God be purely preached within their bounds, the sacraments rightly ministered, the discipline rightly maintained, and the ecclesiastical goods uncorruptly distributed. So they would, in that sense, they would be supervising the diaconate. They have the power to excommunicate the obstinate. And, let's see here. Now, I'm not sure if I can answer your question yet, but it does give a list of reasons why they might... by the like reason, their deposition also pertains to this kind of assembly, as of them that teach erroneous and corrupt doctrine. Okay, so these would be people would be subject to being disciplined, that are of scandalous life, and after admonition desist not. They are given to schism or rebellion against the Kirk, manifest blasphemy, simony, corruption of bribes, falsehood, perjury, whoredom, theft, drunkenness, fighting, worthy of punishment by the law, usury, dancing, infamy, and all others that deserve separation from the Kirk. These also who are found altogether insufficient to execute their charge should be deposed, whereof other Kirks would be advertised, that they receive not the persons deposed. So this could...
Doesn't say how.
Yeah, it doesn't say how, right. But it is, we are talking about deposition here of... Well, certainly of elders, and probably of pastors also, but yeah, it's not exactly spelled out. Did you want to say something, Ron?
Well, I'm kind of wondering when the practice started for pastors to be considered part of the session, for the assembly, general assembly, or...
Well, that was... Yeah, I would say that the general... I mean, in the first book of discipline, there was a general assembly, and the pastors would have been part of it. You're thinking more of the Kirk session itself, or the...
Well, pastors are not, in the PCA, these pastors are not part of their local congregations. They are appointed to a local congregation. But if they're to be disciplined, it's going to be by synod, I don't remember the word... The next level of government higher.
Presbytery.
Presbytery. Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know the history of that thing. I think I've heard it. I've heard it said, before that's the sort of proper thing if the pastor is guilty is to sort of immediately go up to the presbytery level. But to be honest, I don't really know. What the correct procedure is. So
that's why if it started
here or not, is that what you're wondering?
Right.
Yeah. It does say the assembly. Okay, so just the next three paragraphs are on provincial assemblies. Provincial assemblies we call lawful conventions of the pastors, doctors, and other elders of a province, gathered for the common affairs of the Kirk thereof, the Kirks thereof, which also may be called the conference of the Kirk and brethren. Okay, so it says that they're instituted for weighty matters, but it says this assembly has the power to handle, order, and redress all things omitted or done amiss in the particular assemblies. It has the power to depose the office bearers of that province for good and just causes deserving deprivation. And generally, these assemblies have the whole power of the particular elderships wherever they are collected. So, it clearly says that they have the power to depose ministers, so this provincial assembly. It doesn't say, though, that the Kirk session can't also depose the ministers. So. I guess one could imagine that if the pastor runs off with the organist, they wouldn't have organists. but some flagrant, sin that's clearly worthy of deposition, I guess it seems to me that the Kirk session probably could say, that's it, you're deposed. So, but you can also imagine a situation, right, maybe not so flagrant where the session is split and there's some collusion among the pastor and enough of the remaining elders to make up a majority or something so that the justice isn't done at the Kirk session, then clearly the provincial assembly would be able to do that. But I don't know, Rob, I don't know specifically, so. Yes?
I'm wondering, you didn't read the definition of a pastor. You read what a doctor was?
I guess I skipped over it because I think it's more or less the same as before, but that...
Right.
What were you wondering about it? And,
well, I can only imply from the definition of the doctor that the pastor wasn't supposed to be teaching.
No, I don't think that's the case.
Well,
but the pastor was
supposed to be exhorting.
No, he, well, yeah, it's a...
I personally
Yeah, you personally wouldn't enjoy that. Especially if he's just exhorting you all the time. He is. In fact, so I skipped over most of chapter 4, right, which was on pastors. I think you're asking about this distinction, which makes it sound a little bit like pastors aren't to teach simply the word, but they're rather to use wisdom to apply it to their congregation and so on.
I think that role has been defined into the office of a pastor throughout our society. At least in my limited experience.
Yeah, I guess this is something probably we'd have to do, well, I'd probably have to do more research on to sort of say one way or the other. I mean, that it did strike me reading that I expect our pastor, of course, to exhort us and so on, but also to teach us. So.
Would you expect the teacher to not exhort, but just to teach?
Well, you could imagine a seminary professor, for example, teaching about theology without trying to make necessarily a direct application to his class, at least most of the time. I expect that they are going to apply it to their class at times, but you can see his primary role is to teach theology as an academic subject.
That's an artificial distinction.
Okay. Well.
You can't separate.
Yeah. Perhaps. I guess that's that's maybe why I have a hard time understanding exactly what the doctor is besides a seminary professor. So.
I think it would be adequate to separate.
Yeah. Well, that's a question for another day. Okay. That is a good question, Rob. But it goes a lot deeper than just what's in here and whether or not those are, as we've talked about, the purpose of seminaries and so on. You know, obviously there's a lot more to it than just this particular issue.
I was talking about some more practical. They couldn't dancing.
Yeah, I noticed that. I don't have any kind of detailed commentary available on the second book of discipline here. You remember that Knox commented specifically on Mary's dancing, and he said that he didn't mind it so much as long as it wasn't done in to celebrate, the massacres of the Huguenots in France and so on. So,
what would they do today?
Yeah. Well, good question. Okay, well, let's close here. We've got a bit more. I think we've covered most of the sort of interesting things related to A Tale of Two Kingdoms. There's a little bit more on the role of the civil magistrate, which I'd like to cover. And. I guess we'll probably get to that in 2 weeks. So. Let's see. Lang, would you close in prayer?